mark I didn't quite catch. And the ship represented what? The sea represented something, the world, I think, and the ship represented
No, what I'm saying is that it's an allegory that the ship... What Melville was saying, that the ship represented the world as it was in 1860. So when he's describing the ship and the people on it, through his mind he was describing the world. I mean, that's a general rule, I think, of allegory, that you describe a small... piece of something to represent something else, and basically it was a good thing to choose a whaling ship because it was the acme of technological advance in those days. I mean, it doesn't seem much to us now, but nevertheless they it was one of the prime products of American mercantile capital. I mean, we all know about ambergris, don't we? I mean, it seems very strange to find that all the rich and wealthy women of the world desire this ambergris to be made into perfume, and it comes from the bowel of a diseased whale. Ambergris comes from the bowel of a diseased whale. Then again, I think there's a good... The contradiction that we have to live in life, I think this points it out. Something. What do you want?
Does it answer to your question?
Ah, yes. I mean, I thought there was some connection there with the sea. I didn't like to ask, but I probably got it wrong. What does the sea represent? The ship represents...
The sea... Mind you, this is just an interpretation, because it's an interpretation. The sea represents the voyage, not only of the Pequod, but the voyage in which we're going on throughout our life. From the time we're born to the time we die, we're trying to work out what makes things tick, trying to understand the world in which we live. It's rather like, I had a friend of mine, when I was coming in, I said something about, I think it was quite profound what he said. I'd seen Heseltine on the television, and I said, I wonder what makes that man tick. You know, he's pretty close to death. He's had a heart attack. I just quite wondered. And my friend over there said, it's not greed. It's not money. He's already got that. He's got position. What is about this man? What makes him tick? And that is the voyage that, you know what I'm saying, with Melville, that we take. I don't know what makes somebody like Heseltine tick. I mean, it would seem to me, if I was close to death, the sort of person that I am, and mind you, maybe I'm lucky I come from a working class background, I know, but to me, what makes him tick, it seems to me he's diseased. He's an Ahab. That's it. He's an Ahab. So you don't have to ask what... Ahab was diseased. Heseltine's diseased. I don't know whether Heseltine's an Ahab or whether Heseltine is Starbuck, the chief officer. But you work it out. You work it out.
Okay.
You might even like to ask my son an idea of Shakespeare, but that's the time that lands in seven different countries. And everything would be possibly divided. Why would he want to spend his life worrying about children raising on money?
But is that the better part of the human being?
Of course it is.
The better part.
It's the same question from a different point. Why does somebody actually want to do it when he doesn't need to?
Well, that's it seems to me that that's what Melville did his entire life.
So we mustn't assume this from material gain, that means.
No, as I was saying when I said, it's not just material gain. No. You're quite right.
His gift is probably the vanity of the start of what most has.
Sorry, can you speak up, please?
No, Mike.
In his case, it's probably the vanity of the star performer in the House of Commons, because he's got money, he's got position, he's got...
Well, I hope you're right, because it's not so much to beat then, if that's all he's sitting in front of. I think it's a bit more than that, Mike, because he's not much to beat if that's... Well, of course, the important thing is, you see, is when the ship went down, when Ahab went down, the owners were still in Nantucket. Peleg and Bildad, they were still there. Right? It's rather like, we won't say it because it makes me choke up, but it's rather like in the last war when they talk about the people that built the gas stoves and everything, but the people that own the bloody material that made those gas stoves are still there.
And now they're being compensated by the Germans.
That's right. I'd rather not talk, because I get choked up when I talk about that Holocaust period. But that's the essence of it. The two Quaker owners, Quakers, they went to church. And there's some wonderful chapters. They did the these, the thous, and now there it is. But they owned the bloody Pequod. They owned the ship. They were still there. They were still there, the owners were still there. What did they do? They sold. They did a, who was it, the fellow in the good book? He wiped his hands.
Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate, yeah.
Anyone else? Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to make one point in my question. The point was I did agree with you about what you said about the worry about Wales now would not have occurred then. One of the interesting things about capitalism and about the whole story of the whaling industry is how, having got onto a good thing, they made their own whaling stations redundant because of their greed in overfishing all the time. And it got to such, in recent times, I read that the Japanese, who are notorious whalers, accused the dolphins of eating too many of the fish around their coasts. So it is true, they can't even, when it's serving them, they still have to destroy it because of the stupidity of the system. The second thing I wanted to ask was, what exactly was the role of the whale in this allegory then? Was it the focus of power of Ahab? What was it exactly, the whale? Did he have a part to play?
Well, Melville, it was the white whale. It wasn't just a whale. It was a white whale. And the white whale had some metaphysical term at that time, what the whale represented. I look at it rather as though he was chasing the whale, and one of the officers said to him, "Oh, please, Ahab, give up. You're chasing the whale. He's not chasing you." I think Ahab was chasing the whale. At one point, the whale wasn't chasing him. All the whale wanted to do was live a peaceful life and go on doing whatever whales do, quite successfully. You've given me an interesting point, though, because I must admit I've struggled with it for years as to actually what the whiteness of the whale, what the whiteness of the whale represents. But then it's that's the beauty of the book. After all, as I said, I first read it in 1952. There's not many books you can stay with as long as there's so much meat in it. You can pick it up and you can go back to it, and even if you try and trip him up, it all comes out. Do you remember? I remember when we used all these different people, these authors, Jack London, and Dana, and all these people. Maybe it doesn't go on so much now. Well, we haven't got a merchant fleet anymore, have we? I think that Melville has. I think Melville is second to Shakespeare in the what he has to say about the world in which we live, that can stay with him until he got there. And then it's another.
When you say I have resented the system, how did you resent the system?
I have resented the system.
Yeah, you say that.
Well, let's think about today. I'm enjoying life today. As I say, it gave me a pleasure to think about Melville, because when we spoke about it on Ellis Island, I wasn't working. I had 9 months into a stroke. No bother to us. We sat around and we talked. We didn't even have to buy money to buy beer. And now we have a situation today where, I don't know, give or take, I mean, it doesn't really matter. They give or take 4 million, 3.5 million, 5 million unemployed. I understand today they've knocked the dole entitlement now from 1 year down to 6 months. They did that on the radio just as I came here. Well, that'll reduce the number of unemployed. That'll stop by a million. So, you know, so pretty soon we'll be able to say, carry on this way, we've got overemployment. We're in a sort of a minus situation. This is the madness of it all, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I would have said.
Oh, this, it's, that's right. Now, this business, what the comrade asked me about the resentment, now,
it's called creative accountants.
It would appear to me that those that are selling their labour today, say they're working for ICL or something, and ICL sacks, makes redundant, gives the push, whatever, those that are left, by their very definition, have the ones that have been sacked are a charge upon the people that's left working. And if I was one of those left working, I'd have a resentment against those that weren't working. Because they're a charge on me. Because I'm producing surplus value for that bugger that ain't working. I'm one of those buggers that ain't working, incidentally. I'm the charge on whoever's who's working. But can't you see the resentment, isn't that?
Yeah.
The resentment that somebody... I mean, that comes home from work at 8 o'clock at night, knackered. He ain't got time to read. He ain't got time to sort out this, that and the other. He's got to get into bed. And then he has to open up his paper and read about the problems of the unemployed. They got too much bloody leisure now. Super capitalist. Not enough. Too much.
Thank you.
Can you see the resentment?
Yes, understand.
And specifically about Ahab, it does need to be said that if you could spend 40 years at sea and only spend 4 years at home, there's enough resentment there. Feminine companionship, you've got enough to be resentful about.
Yeah. Tom. Anyone?
Perhaps the white whale represents the ever-elusive peace which we constantly pursue.
Right. They are
mistakenly militated against.
Well, that's it. That's what's good about these things, because you can get people G'd up from. Because incidentally, when we used to have these things in Ellis Island, we all used to sit round in the circle. We didn't have platform. We didn't know about platform. Yeah. Right. Anything else? Anybody disagree with the interpretation?
Not disagreeing, but as you said earlier on about academics who go away and deconstruct novels and books to interpret from their own point of view or whatever the tutors want. But I mean, himself, what kind of background did he have? In the sense that, I mean, he's seen all that was probably going around him in America at the time. But I mean, what political ideas? I mean, he had American independence, you know, the rights of man, probably. Money assumes. I mean, what was his background?
Well, you know, Melville had a bit of a thing about somebody called Anacharsis Clootz. Anacharsis, it's an interesting name, Anacharsis Clootz was a Prussian nobleman that was involved at the time of the French Revolution, you see, and he had all these ideas about a brotherhood of the human world and everything like that. But Melville makes quite a few specific references that he's a bit of an Ishmael. I mean, being as Ishmael is the narrator, it's very easy to be on the side of Ishmael, but you have to be very wary of the Ishmael. Because what the Ishmaels do is, it seems to me, looking back in the history that we live, minus 65 years of it, they demoralise you. They don't help you, they demoralise you. And that's why I think it repays understanding of the Ishmaels of the world, the people that are going to help us. There's only one people going to help us, that's us. We don't do it, nobody's going to do it.
Yeah.
So,
I see that they were programmed on the BBC2 or Channel 4. And the people who this is quite real business. That kind of mythological picture. Has it got any relationship to the real thing? No,
Oh, well, yeah, you know, in the whale fishery, there were, it's not particularly mythological. There were, I mean, you can imagine most whales wanted to get away from the whaling ships. They wanted to live. They wanted to populate. But some whales, there was actually, where Melville got the name Moby Dick was from something called Moocha Dick, which was an actual whale, it was a cussed whale, who fought back. He actually decided to ram the ship that was chasing him. And no, there were quite whales that fought back, and because they were wooden ships and this, that and the other, they were quite able to sink them. It wasn't just a myth, no. It wasn't just a myth.
Because the Kaiju people who typically there was a creature who lived in harmony with its
That's right.
The only on shrimp, is this or shrimp, or the
krill.
Krill, is it?
That's it. In the first front of this book here, it goes into all of the people going back to about the year 1400 that have ever spoken about whales. A great history of cetology. This is kind of great. The fact that the whale was harmonious, lived together, procreated, you know, he didn't do anybody any harm. But that's not to decry the material world that existed where, until the coming of Thomas Edison when he turned the light on, and earth oil, oil that comes out the ground. Until the coming of that, people, I mean, what's this, oil for the lamps of China. That's how they lit their homes, to read their books and to go about their business. So that it had a harmonious balance in the world. What modern industry does is, like it does, it kicks it out of balance to the detriment of the poor bloody whale.
Of course, there's another bit which quoted in the title. Whereas Jonas fired away, whereas a queen by fair nature is incapable of
swallowing a human being.
You have nothing to fall into.
No, you're
right. It's another type of thing we call a shock wave, which in ordinary waves all live completely in harmony. And it is more than that of communication.
That's right. Music.
Music, yes. And,
using the waves of the sea. Using the waves of the sea, yeah. Yeah. Beautiful.
This business of Jonah and the waves of the Bible is complete fantasy. Like most of the Bible is, isn't it?
And you get it. You get it. If you use it, it's about that much. All devoted to the what he calls cetology.
Did the whale swallow
Jonah in the Bible? I can't remember.
Yes, the
swallow.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know.
While we carry on discussion, now I would like to make a question. Because we depended, you know, from the meeting's place, for the deep pocket place. Proletarian literature in the US was powerful at that time, the 1950s. Can you explain more? When you see our James, when you.
You see, bearing in mind it's sort of shaded by the optimism of looking backwards, you know. Nostalgia punts things in a bit better shape than it was. But I do think that specifically American literature at that time said an awful lot, because American society at that time, I don't want to use the word the American dream, but it meant something to Americans. It meant something to them. We don't have anything called the English dream. You know, we don't have a word for it, but the American dream meant something. And it meant that lots of these authors came along because of the democracy, inverted commas, in America, came from the working class. People like Nelson Aldrich, I'm sorry, all of the writers of the 30s, I'm particularly thinking of. Norris, who wrote The Octopus, wasn't it? Even Jack London. So that they wrote from their own experience, and out of the vibrancy that America was in that period, there was an awful lot of literature that you as a working person could read and not feel alienated from, because it wasn't, inverted commas, bookish. And it spoke to you in words that you understood, to make sense of this world which you understood. I'll give you a little example. I saw something the other night on television. They were talking about, it was about the boneless marches in Washington. Did anybody see it? Ah, interesting. Now, did you notice there was an American general there called Smedley talking to the boneless marchers as one of them?
Yes, that's right.
An American General Smedley. And what struck me at the time was I couldn't imagine in my wildest dreams that the class structure that we have in Britain could have allowed an English general to stand up and talk with his sleeves up, rolled up, haranguing the crowds as one of them. Did you see that General Smedley there?
Did you also see MacArthur?
And Eisenhower. Yeah, they were all there. But there was a bit of fluidity about America. I mean, one of the reasons why, as I say, we jumped ship. There was a bit of hope and fluidity about America at that period. That I do think it's worth reading some of that literature. You know, you can go to any library and get them. But, I mean, a lot of them didn't amount to very much.
What was the programme? I think it was the BBC Two.
What was it, Flynn?
The American Depression. This is another four series.
Yeah.
It was on the television. BBC Two.
Who were the other? There was MacArthur, and who was two lieutenants?
Patton, Eisenhower,
and MacArthur beating down the boneless masses.
Interesting.
It was Roosevelt who led away with the New Deal, you know.
They did vote in that. They did vote a lot of them. You know, the next election that came, they did have a clean sweep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was after who.
Sorry, again, I'm voting for the same
thing. But as I say, not to get too... I mean, it's because I cut my teeth on it. And I suppose there is a book called You Can't Go Home Again. It says if you leave your own country, you can see it more clearly. And that happened to me very young, when I was about 17, 18. I left my country, and you could look at it very clearly when you go somewhere. I got an awful lot from American literature of that period. Basically, I think because you broke out of the specific class structures of England, which we do have. I think we must say there are specific class structures in England that it's a liberation when you leave them.
Because they were under British colony.
Huh?
America and the British colony. Yeah.
America, well, as I say, there were plenty of people. There were plenty of people on Ellis Island and come from all sorts of places in the British colony.
Yes, they're the best.
There's a line, I can't remember who wrote it. What do they know of England who only England know? I was thinking, looking at this people, that Thoreau, much earlier, spoke of the radicality and enterprise of the fluidity of American society, which did have that genuine appeal to it until the latter days of settlement. Great appeal for people.
Mind you, Michael, I must say this because I've been involved in this world. America and democracy and everything. And I must say, it had something to say. Capital is riding it to its doom. Not the working people of America. Capital. Now, I mean, look at the way they did with Clinton. They had a whole It must have been multi-millions of pounds that they spent. And I watched it, even I began to think, geez, am I some kind of a nut? I'm watching this glorious, wonderful production, telling me some, yet again, yet another wonderful president. It's all been done before, but it's done so with such power and such strength that you find yourself believing it. For a second, or a split second. But what I worry about is my children. That's what I worry about.
Not exactly, but I didn't quite get that. What were you referring to
regard to
with this wonderful something about Clinton?
I was trying to tie it in with what's called, you know, the expression, the American dream?
Yes.
And it does have some relevance to American working people.
Once, because there was loads of space, there was loads of opportunity.
Right. That's
but then
right.
Eventually you got the reach of them, you got the Ku Klux Klan, and then you got private enterprise, and they didn't even have a labour party like we have in Britain. And the whole thing is, and it's with guns, everyone carrying guns.
But this is what I'm trying to say, we mustn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Inherent in that American dream was a dream of brotherhood. As we saw in that film about the bonus marchers, there was no Jim Crow in that bonus camp. On those flats. Jim Crow had gone. There was no Jim Crow with those bonus marches. That's part of the American dream.
A long time ago.
Well,
yeah.
I would venture to suggest that the greater the problems become, you could shoot every socialist there is, but a new crop would come tomorrow because the problems are there. The problems created by capital. So we must be really downhearted, aren't we? I'm not sure I get the best.
Yeah, excuse me, the one in
China.
Yeah, I think actually the point about there not having been a Labour Party in America, although there was a flourishing socialist movement there, it was crushed by force, by some of the most ruthless force that there has been in history, both the Red Scare, the time of the First World War and after it, and then, of course, subsequently, McCarthyism, which was only actually, and very interesting that now, in Eastern Europe, people are beginning to face up to the ethical consequences of Stalinism. But a similar thing is not happening in America, and it should be. But actually, what I want to say about the issue of the Labour Party was that the reason that American literature has had such a rich vein of genuine working class radicalism within it is precisely because you didn't have a Labour Party trying to run capitalism. See, I would say that it was after the 1920s when the Labour Party committed that ultimate betrayal of trying to play around and run capitalism. I'm not suggesting that the Labour Party had ever been out to do anything else incidentally, but it was very clear after the ramping of Donald governments, what Labour politics was about. And then in 1945 and subsequently, I think this has crushed the artistic work out of any kind of genuine working class writing. In fact, it's in the 1980s, when the working class has been losing on every other front, that there's been a resurgence of really good working class writing, really good socialist writing. Particularly plays as it's David Hare and all these other people and Trevor Griffiths. But in America, it was precisely because so much of the political force and lack of radicalism had been destroyed, people didn't know where to turn, that it was coming out in terms of poetry, in terms of novels, in terms of plays. I would class along with Melville, who I would agree, not just for Moby Dick, as you rightly say, but for other writings as well, as one of the finest writers that there has ever been, including a novel of his called The Confidence Man, which I think was probably a better novel than Moby Dick. I don't speak with anything like the expertise of the speaker. I haven't spent the time reading Melville's writings, but I think it's a superb novel. I also think that if anybody wants to cut their teeth on Melville, because very often it's quite hard when you talk about these things and you have to go away and spend a certain amount of time.
Oh my God, give me a cup of tea.
Yeah, well,
D.H. Lawrence is a good idea, because before you read the novels of D.H. Lawrence, I'd say, read some of the shorter pieces, read some of those poems that he wrote, and D.H. Lawrence is worth reading. But in relation to Melville, that short story, wrote many short stories, which weren't really published until this century, if you rightly say, in the 1920s, I believe, they really started to be published in any great significant, in any great number. Which was called Bartleby the Scrivener. You mentioned it. About the office worker.
Made a film. Never seen it.
I didn't ever know it was a film. But I mean, one of the great things about that, of course, is here you have a man. He's not on a ship. The point about the ships that Melville wrote about, and he wrote one novel, I haven't read it, about a ship of war. Because he was also in the Navy as well, as being a merchant seaman. He travelled back to America from the job on a merchant ship,
on a
warship, and he wrote a novel about that as well. But what was interesting about Bartleby the Scrivener is this is about an office clerk who tries to jump ship. So in other words, reading about that, and you suddenly discover the guy walks out of the office. He says, "I don't want to be a worker in an office anymore." Well, that's great. What are you going to do? Oh, he's a slave as well. He's a deserter as well. Yeah. You've got to get back there, because you discover you're in the land of the free, but there's this magnetic force called the wages system that pulls you back, and suddenly find you're back where you started. Right. So you're in chains. I think Melville was growing up, but incidentally, I was talking about playwrights, I would couple with him as one of the great American writers, Clifford Odets, the playwright. Who, I'm not thinking of Waiting for Lefty, I'm not thinking of that play, because it was a rather simplistic, rather facile sort of agitprop, although it's good to read. He wrote a number of other ones, I can't remember the
names. Golden Boy was a good one.
Golden Boy, and there's one that's called, it's based on a quotation from the book of Isaiah. It's called something like Isaiah, I think it's called. And that's a superb
Absalom?
Well, that was a Yeah, no, that wasn't the name of the one, but there's all of these plays I'd recommend to you. You see, I think the reason you've got people like that, J.T. Farrell, again, another one who is writing, remarkably important novels, and you couldn't imagine them having been written in Britain. I think the reason was that the left in Britain was compromised terribly by its infatuation with the idea that you could run the capitalist state in the interest of the working class. And because that makes you dishonest. And when you're dishonest, you may well be a good politician, you may well be a good Ahab, but you can't be a good bloody artist. You can't draw, you can't write, you can't act with any integrity once you are embroiled in that. And that is why the British left, most of the Western European left actually, has been so redundant. I mean, I was associated many years ago with an institution called Unity Theatre. I worked with it at that time. But unfortunately, although Unity Theatre produced some of the finest plays of writers who were writing in the working class tradition, many of the people associated with it were so corrupted by the fact that they were having to say things which they couldn't convince themselves of, let alone convince other people, because they were defending dictatorships in the name of freedom, they were defending government power in the name of some sort of socialism, that they found themselves artistically sapped of any kind of energy. And I found myself among them. I'm not scoring a sectarian point, because I actually worked amongst those people who were, some of them in the Communist Party, some in the Labour Party, others were in neither. But they, I would say, were culturally destroyed by that. And very few people have managed to do this. Now, in the States, I think that the reason you've got your... I mean, Melville was writing before all of this, but the reason you've got the popularity of such literature, the reason you've got your J.T. Fowler, the reason you've got your Clifford Odets, the reason you've got Paul Robeson, was because these people were not identified with something which was so integrated into the capitalist system and which had accommodated itself, found itself a nice little parliamentary niche or a place on a local council where you... were given a grant to, you know, to say that they were constantly involved in a process of struggle. And we are now seeing this repeating itself in the 1980s and 1990s, where we're having a very vigorous artistic fight back. In fact, it's in one area where the working class is winning the class struggle, in my view,
yeah.
is in the terrain of literature, plays, and so on. In fact, as a matter of fact, that's why the ruling class are very worried about television, they're very worried about the press and so on, because they realise that the only way you can appeal to workers these days is by using working class language. Now that's an area where I think we're winning. We're doing very well indeed, unfortunately, politically and in many other respects. We're very much facing a hard time. And I think that's one of the reasons why American working class literature has an enduring power about it, which I think is unique. I can't think of any other country that has produced a collection of writers who have such a degree of uncorrupted energy.
Yeah, that's the energy and the vitality.
Thank you. Yes?
Yeah, just go back to what you mentioned earlier on about class structure. The mistake to think that Americans don't have classes, of course, they do. But the point about there is that it's simply based on money. You have had it or they don't. In this country, class structure is based on much more insidious things than that. Like background, birth, speech, all kinds of stuff and things, which make it more complicated.
Yeah. Well, I've struggled with this for years. I'll be quite frank, this particularity. This, and I've been slagged off by people in when I've been involved. But this particularity, this uniqueness of British class structure, it's a problem. I suppose we'll go on wrestling with it, and only a revolution will solve the problem. But it is, at this present time and in the past, it has been a particularly unique thing which applies because of the early Industrial Revolution. We could go on again. You could have a whole series of studies on that. But when we go back and we read our books, I think we are invested with this problem.
It's a very subtle thing, too. It's going to be a great example. This was a story of a few years ago, there was a newscaster went down to interview some old aristocrat now on the country estate. The rest of it is your grace, estates in several different counties back in the Middle Ages, and now you've only got one in this particular county. And what happened to ancestors who reduced to one estate in the county? How did you manage to lose so many lands? And they said, it was just general carelessness, I think. And then he went on and said, this old boy was complaining because he didn't have a cigar anymore after dinner, because death duties had done for us, and this, that, and the other thing went down the world a bit. And the newscaster mentioned to him, said, well, he said, yes, of course, reduced straits, reduced circumstances. And he mentioned a scrap dealer in a town nearby who was a millionaire. And this old boy said, yes, you said, Charles. Yes, I've heard about that. Well, really, now. Would you be able to buy me out himself? I shouldn't wonder. And then these classes said, well, yes, but you must admit your grace. He's a millionaire, he's very successful, but he's done it through work. And so the old boy said, yes. Yes, he said, there's money some people want to do for money.
Yes, but you've really got a sharp division, and you can see what you say to your life. The fact is that the business section, epitomized perhaps by Margaret Thatcher, has always attacked the aristocracy, not because of the things that are obviously, bad about the aristocracy, but because they themselves are, they felt, as our friend said, they would go bankrupt because they tend to run down the idea of the grocery trade and the rest of it. They rise above their standards and their aspirations are quite different from those of the business. And in the two, I should imagine the economic threat from our economic sources are far greater for the people. They've done far more harm. They're doing it every minute with these things.
Yeah. Incidentally, on that English pastor, just while I came out, I heard something, an American comedian. He said, why are these English country? He said, these English people say things twice, he said. He said, they say things like, here, here. I say. He said, well, I say what? I say, I say. Hear, hear. And he said they repeat themselves all the time. They never say, actually say anything at the end of it.
But the interesting thing about this story is that it showed the attitude in this country, which I think hasn't died yet, that having the money is not the point, it's how you've got it. There is the right way of having money and there's the wrong way. Whereas in America, it doesn't matter how you get it, as long as you've got it, that's all that matters. But here, there's respect for the money.
That's the wrong kind of wealth. But at least you can go to the library, like the Carnegie Library. I just looked at
through the purple ranks of commerce, it's all right.
You see, Andrew Carnegie, and he gave us the libraries. Mind you, it came up from Carnegie, but he never gave advice to his workers in America, incidentally. They never got a bean. The last time I saw this was in the Carnegie Library. I went back and asked her. He said, no, the woman said, I don't know what's happening. They're always stealing it. So that's good, really, isn't it? Prison literature, mind you, as far as I was concerned, I cursed the bugger that stole it. But it disappears from the library, so it must be very popular. That's a certain guarantee of popularity. I mean, it's a bit antisocial, but...
Yes.
I mean, I was going to say that class. I think the British class system has become Americanized to a very great extent. I wouldn't worry too much about the aristocracy and our effect. Well, you're evidently not, neither am I. I would say that the thing that's happened in relation to Britain is the British talk about class. And the thing about English literature is always the narrative of English literature is always class written. If, for example, within Dickens, who was writing at the same time as Mowbray, wasn't it? And Dickens will begin by describing somebody before they speak in such a way that he has tied them up. if he doesn't, because I was looking at this just the other day, the trade union organiser, Slapbridge, in Hard Times. And he gets up and he describes Slapbridge addressing a union meeting, and he said he wiped his corrugated forehead with a pad of damp cloth, and then returned to his sneering bitterness. And then he begins the quotation, "Ah, my fellow workers." You see, so anyone reading it straight away is going to say, "Well, bloody hell, this fellow's not on our side, is he?" Of course, Dickens doesn't tell you in the novel that he just come back from reporting, from being a prostitute reporter up in the Preston textile strike, which was going on right away across Lancashire. And of course he watched these strike meetings, and although his heart bled for the poor, he didn't like the idea of them doing anything about it for themselves. He wanted it, he wanted reforms to be enacted for the working class. And this went right the way through Victorian writing. And this was the thing that class is talked about here. Now in America, very little literature talks about class. It's a taboo word. Even now, the two things you can never say to an American, you can't talk to an American about which class they're in. And in Britain, all the surveys right up to this day show that something like 75-80% of people think they're in the working class, which is a good statistic. In America, everybody will tell you they're in the middle class. 90% in all the surveys say they're in the middle class. You talk to Clinton, he's in the middle class, he's doing well. You talk to the bag lady in New York, she's in the middle class, she's not doing so well. But they're all in the middle class. They're all in there. And the thing about the class system, the class thing is something that the ruling class have got on their mind here. They want to keep the thing going. But you've got to realise, it's gone through some appalling embarrassments in recent years, not least over the thing of the monarchy. I think socialists often take the monarchy not seriously enough. Some people say we take it too seriously, after who cares about them, they're irrelevant, and so on. Well, they are irrelevant, but they're symbolic. Within English culture, I'm addressing the question you've raised, and that's a rare thing to do at a socialist meeting, but I thought, why not break a habit of a lifetime? I'm addressing a point you've actually spoken about, the English class system. I think the monarchy is important. I always remember when the Queen's daughter, she was the first one to get married, and the Queen was, in those days, the Queen didn't have anything to be interviewed on television. And they said, how do you feel about your daughter getting married? Well, she couldn't
express any human sentiment, like, you know, I'm delighted or whatever. She said, as far as the institution of marriage is concerned, all I can say is, I am for it. And some of you might remember that. Well, of course, that sentence had a double meaning when you think about it, because she was for it. Every one of her kids' marriages has ended in rotten failure, hasn't it? You know, except for Edward, who they don't even, you know, they don't even talk about. And this is, I think, the problem, that the English class system, as in its traditional sense, has now become an embarrassment and ridiculous. And I might just make one point, which is one other point, and that is that years ago there was a question very often asked about, well, look, socialism can come about, but are we going to have to wait for the last, you know, the most backward group of people on earth? And the way the question was phrased, in the, if you read literature from the Socialist Party in the 1930s and 1940s, people used to say, are we going to have to wait for the last Hottentot to understand socialism? Well, of course, if you talk to the workers in Southern Africa today, they can say, are we going to have to wait for the last week to understand socialism? Yeah. The English class system has been a great problem in terms of people being able to break through and understand what's going on.
Is that part of the problem or part of the solution?
Dialectical problem. Bit of fun. Right.
Yeah, thank you. Yes.
I might do it one point. He hasn't put it so eloquently because he doesn't get the air or the TV time to do so. His interviews are very short. But Anthony Wakefield Bennett has tried to make the points publicly, which our friend has been able to make more eloquently during this evening. But there is this deep strata in the work sector, which still evokes a radical cause. Somebody might have taken in, or might be impressed by the exterior aspects of American culture, and they're only going to tell us which are safe to do so, you could say. But they don't go to the areas where the Americans themselves are unfortunately abandoned a lot of that safety.
But we march to a different drum.
Okay, thank you for a contribution of £12.16, which is 34 pence short for the red.
Thank you.
Anyone before we test it?
A collection today. This is a lovely. This is the only organisation you pay to listen to yourself speaking.
Is it tea ready?
Yeah.
Yes, tea is ready. Thank you, comrades and friends.